Welcome to Amazon Legends, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became power sellers. Also providers specializing in helping sellers, aggregators that acquire sellers, and former Amazonians will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here is your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today previously worked in an ad agency running ads. And after spending some time and seeing how much the service could be better and more could be offered, he decided to go on his own and start his own operation. Today, he's the founder of Stones Goods, and he's a full-service Amazon agency. And he lives in San Diego, so he naturally loves surfing, but also teaching people. So he does that in the most honorable way, where it's his way of giving back. And also he enjoys teaching and empowering people, which frankly is what got him to leave and go on his own, because he felt he could do a lot more. So that's how he operates. So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Sean Stone. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you very much.
Oh, that's a pleasure to have you. You know, there is somebody said this to me a while ago, and then I think about my own experience, and it's so true. Teaching is the best way to learn.
Yep, I agree. I mean, if you can't teach someone something, you don't understand it at a basic enough level. And so that's the way that I've always thought about it, is even when I'm learning something, I try to teach it to myself, because that's my litmus test for how well I know it.
Yeah, yeah. So teaching is always a good thing. So you and I had a blast when we first connected, and we were talking about what could we do. And I was so humbled by the prep work you had in terms of the things that we could talk about. And oh my God, I thought that we want to cover this all. So we've got a lot. We picked very good subjects. And for our listeners, they're going to have a blast. We have a loaded agenda, and we'll cover two strategically valuable areas. And everybody listening, you want to stay tuned, because we are going to dive right into where the action is. And that's data and how you use it and what are things that you can do to scale your operation. But most important, what Sean says is, how do you achieve consistent and predictable results?
Yeah.
That's what we're going to do. So tell us, Sean, what are we going to cover today?
So we're going to first talk about how to use account structure and a good plan to achieve consistent, repeatable results inside your account, both from an advertising and total sales perspective. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about and hopefully share with your listeners is the search query performance report and where the gold can be found, because there's some real gold inside that report if you know where to look. Okay. So that's what I think we should cover. Does that sound good?
Well, you are the boss in terms of chasing the value, and both of these things that you mentioned could be so complex. And if done wrong, this is another thing. Like, the first part we're going to talk about is how to organize your advertising structure, right? This is not about data. This is about how to set up your campaigns and then how to organize them, so that way you can isolate issues when they occur and therefore drive the outcome that you want. This is something that is so important. And if it's not done right, it takes forever to clean up and fix, right? So
yeah,
talk about strategic. This is as strategic as any work can be. And then we'll dive into the search query performance, which is very much underutilized by sellers. They don't even know where it is, some of them. So, and we're going to find exactly how to get the most out of it. So let's dive right in. Let's start with the advertising data. So walk us through, what's the best way to structure it?
Okay, I'm going to just tell you exactly what it is, value up front, then I'm going to explain what each of them are, and then I'm going to tell you why it matters. So my structure and the structure I believe is the best for both isolation and then maximizing results is first having one product per portfolio, then having one campaign per purpose per product, then one ad group per campaign per portfolio per product, per campaign per purpose, and then one match type per ad group. So each of those is a parent onto each other. So let's talk about what that actually means. One product per portfolio means we've got one product that is either your parent ASIN or your child ASIN. Traditionally, it's your parent ASIN, but then you only advertise one of the children because that child ASIN is the one that is going to have the best outcome from an advertising perspective. The 80-20 rule applies anywhere, but especially when you're selling anything that either has color variance or size variance. And then once we jump off that, it's one campaign per purpose. And you'd say, like, well,
Hold on. I have a question because we want to dissect this as we go along, right? And I want to give you the what if scenarios and see what you think about it. So sometimes there are multiple variations. Like I have a client that has 10 variations under one parent. And one or two of them, or say three of them, outperform the others. Then they start to cannibalize the sales on the underperforming ones. So therefore, there comes a time you have to make a decision. And the decision is to separate that outperforming ASIN and then take it on its own, perhaps. Or leave it where it is and then advertise another one under the same parent. So, how do you deal with advertising multiple child's ASINs under the same parent when you have this approach?
So, context matters a lot, and I have gone through like basically this structure that I'm talking about is battle tested. I've had some very challenging scenarios that we've been able to turn around, and every time we do it by using the structure. So to talk about your specific scenario, if for example, so if it's three different colors of a product on a parent ASIN, then we'll take one strategy. And if it's three almost irrelevant to each other products, we might take a different approach. And then if it's three different sizes, we'll take a different approach. So I want to cover each of those, and I'm going to talk about each one sequentially. So if it's three different colors, there's going to be one color that outperforms the rest. You don't even need to go look at the PPC data because you'll be able to see it in the search data. Again, we'll talk about search query performance later, but generally there'll be way more search for one of these than the other. And then how do I handle this? I would advertise only the one that's got the best performance from a color perspective. And then I would have specific color-based campaigns for the other colors if I wanted to push them. And so we have a term internally. We call it the velocity ASIN. And so we would choose a velocity ASIN and then make that the primary ASIN we advertise. And when you talk about cannibalization, how do we handle cannibalization in this scenario? In general, so what we recommend our clients do is just sell as much as possible of on the entire parent ASIN. And when you're reordering, start to adjust for that new ratio that you're likely to see. And the one thing that you might want to think about over time is, okay, well, we are way overstocked on this one. What do we do about it? Run a promotion, run a lightning deal, run a 7-day deal, run some kind of specialty deal that's going to get additional traffic to that one variation and incentivize consumers to buy. It could be a coupon, it could be a price drop, it could be a lower price than the rest of them. I've seen each of those different scenarios play out in a color-based scenario. So before I move on to the next, does the color-based scenario make sense?
So what I'm also kind of hearing as the objective is to really get out of the ones that are not performing well. So honing on the ones that are performing the best and stuck up on those, and then ultimately you have less variations to focus on. That's really the bigger strategy here that you're driving it, right?
Yeah. And we're thinking about this from like a return on your dollars. Like, what can you do to get the most dollars out of your own business? Like, if you think about your Amazon business as a stock, and you put $1 in on this one product and you get $3 back, and you put $1 in on this other product and you only get $1.50 back, why don't we maximize those returns for you by taking a look at where you're getting the best outcome?
Exactly. And the critical thing there is the time frame, right? In that same time frame, how much are you getting from each one of those child ASINs? And of course, you just follow the one that's giving you the most cash in that same time frame.
So, exactly.
Yeah.
And then, and this is a completely different discussion, but there's also the scenarios. We've also had quite a few scenarios where we had to deal with liquidation. And the strategies and tactics you can use to try to liquidate a product that you're going to discontinue or you're aggressively overstocked on. That was something that hit us quite drastically towards the tail end of 2021, because people were placing gigantic orders for their products based on sales volume that they're making in early to mid 2020. So, you know, it's easy to forecast, or it, well, first of all, it's easy to look back and say, oh, what a mistake. But like at the time, nobody knew what was going to happen. Retail stores were closed for a long period of time and nobody knew what to do about it. So yeah, not trying to be on a high horse here, just trying to call out like a reason why we came across this scenario.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the color scenario. What about the unrelated? Let's discuss the unrelated.
Yes. So the unrelated or semi-related. So this is, you know, this is the traditional scenario where a seller has been around for a while and they start trying to game the variation system. And, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I'm above that. I mean, there's always some gray area where you can potentially see some efficiencies. But really what I would be doing in that scenario is looking for, once again, the 80-20 based on which products on that parent ASIN are seeing the best outcomes. And if the different products on that parent ASIN have similar or unrelated search volumes, because what you really want to do is kind of dissect that search volume to see which products need to be advertised on which search terms and which ones don't need to be, so that you don't necessarily have that crossover. So maybe you're selling shoes as a theoretical example, and you put some tennis shoes and some basketball shoes on the same variation. They're technically shoes. They're just different styles of shoe. And then there's also different size variations. But what you kind of need to think about is like, okay, so these ones are for tennis, so I should probably focus on tennis-related keywords here. And then these ones are for basketball. I should focus on basketball-related keywords here. And realistically, probably only focus on one or maybe two sizes. And then only the style and sizes go after the specific keywords, and the style and sizes go after the other specific keywords. And then you choose whichever one's performing the best of those two, and they'll get all the generic terms as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's the general approach I'll use for a semi-related product. Okay. Yeah.
And the sizes, different sizes, they're similar to colors, right?
So it's, I would argue it's the best of the variation options, because if someone's coming and you sell just three different sizes of the same thing, so maybe we should describe it as count. For example, if you're selling supplements, you've got a 100 count and a 200 count. Mm-hmm. The 100 count, or whatever the lowest count, most likely will have the highest conversion rate, unless there's something very wrong with your listing, because Amazon shoppers want the cheapest thing. And even if the cost per count is higher on the cheapest thing, they'll probably go for that. We actually, side note, ran an experiment where we kept lowering the price of the 200 count to the 100 count. And we got it like within 20%, and people still didn't shift their sales from the 100 count to the 200 count. And it's just because the way shoppers work, they're kind of blindly just, they're like, that one's cheap. That one solves my needs right now. I'm going to buy that one. Even if that one's better, I won't buy it until later, because right now I just want to spend the least amount of money on this product at this time. So what I would recommend people do with their advertising there is focus the majority of their spend on their lowest count or lowest size or lowest quantity, whatever we want to call it, ASIN. And then for specific bulk ASIN searches, spend advertising dollars on the other products on those. So maybe I sound, or maybe I sell a 100 count, a 200 count, and a 400 count. My 200 and 400 count, I would only be going after 200 and 400 count terms or bulk supplement terms, just to kind of talk about how I would use advertising to maximize my conversion rate and spend the dollars where I'm going to get the best return and cut as much spend as I can from the situations where I'm going to get a weak return, especially when, and that's especially true of like mixing ASINs inside of a campaign. I really try not to do that as much as possible, because like, unless there's multiple sizes, because sometimes sizes have, like shoe sizes have wonky scenarios, but like 100 count, I don't want to have the 200 count in that same campaign. Yeah. I just want to be very focused and specific.
So are you then setting up separate campaigns for each one of those additional child SKUs?
Yes. But only for the specific purposes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which yeah. leads perfectly into campaigns. So I only have one campaign per purpose. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay, fine. Great. So one portfolio per SKU and then one campaign
per purpose.
Per purpose.
So let's talk about what a purpose is. Because you can have campaigns can have all kinds of different purposes. You can have a automatic campaign. You can have just one targeting type of an automatic campaign. That could just be a single purpose if you want it to be. You can have a research keyword-based campaign. You can have a category targeting campaign. You can have an automatic campaign. You can have a winning keywords campaign. You can have a single keyword campaign, primarily use those for ranking. You can have a video campaign that could be research or it could be winners. Like you can do all kinds. Oh, and you can do product targeting campaigns, but just specific product targeting. And so there's lots of different campaigns that you can build up over time. And what we try our hardest not to do is have a multi-purpose campaign. Mm-hmm. And so obviously when we take over an account, we try to we don't turn anything off. So but I was thinking of talking about a section where like what to do if your campaign's not set up perfectly right now. We can talk about that in a bit, but in general, we try not to mix campaigns, and we try to slowly undo mixed campaign or mixed purpose campaigns over time. Mm-hmm. So does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So single purpose. So on the portfolio, you have purpose.
Yeah. So you've got one ad group per campaign. Yeah. Generally speaking, if you have multiple ad groups in your campaigns anyway, there's usually one or two top performers and the rest are just kind of sucking wind. So we just try not to have an additional campaign or additional ad group per campaign, just one.
Mm-hmm. And then under ad group,
we try to only have one match type per ad group. So this becomes very important if you, for example, have a lot of keywords inside of your campaigns, because it gets really hard to control which search terms you're going to be advertising on. Because if you've got a keyword in broad match and phrase match, and then also exact match, you kind of have this crazy coverage coming from this campaign. But they're also all fighting each other. The broad match bid is fighting the phrase match bid, which is fighting the exact match bid to win whatever search term it might be triggered for. And so instead of doing that, we try to just have one match type per ad group. And then traditionally, we'll either do, like if we're doing a research campaign, it'll either be broad or phrase. Winners will primarily be exact. But the general idea there is we're not fighting with ourselves. We can't have duplicate keywords inside of an ad group that way, because you can only have one keyword per ad group. That's like an Amazon limitation, not an us limitation. And so that's the way that we do this.
Yeah. So that's great. Yeah. So you are completely isolating every single potential scenario. And then if you decide to let go some of the keywords or move some of the keywords from broad to exact, you can easily do that. And also, if the SKU is not performing, you can easily, you know, either reduce the bid all the way so that the campaign stays active, because you never know, but that's one way to do it. Okay, so that structure, so that trickles all the way down to the keyword, right?
Yeah. And so I guess something that isn't necessarily structural, but procedural, is we will, when migrating a term from broad to phrase or phrase to exact, we will use the negative exact in the source ad group, so that we are not double spending and potentially competing with ourselves between two campaigns. Mm-hmm. And we actually go a step further and proactively look for search terms inside of our accounts where we're fighting with ourselves, because we've seen that as a great way to profitably reduce your ad spend. Because so many times when I take over an account, we'll have the same search term being triggered in like 10 different campaigns for the exact same product. Not multiple products, just the exact same product. And what we'll end up doing is showing that brand owner, hey, you're paying as low as 60 cents a click and as much as $4 a click for this same search term. I want to isolate this down to one place and make sure it's treated like the VIP keyword that it is. And that is the whole point of having such a rigid structural process. There is another more key benefit for repeatability. So I can get into that in a second, but I saw your face light up. So I want to see if you had any follow-up questions there.
No. I mean, this is perfectly easy to follow. My only question here is, since you want to cover all different scenarios with the campaigns, doesn't it get hard to manage so many? Because this means so many campaigns, so many ad groups, so many of those. What are some practical tips you can offer?
So we think about things very specifically here. So there are a couple of things that definitely... I agree 100%. This could be very time consuming, and this could also be very problematic to understand. The one counterpoint I would say to that is that all these keywords already exist inside of your account, but you might just have fewer campaigns to display all of them. But what we're doing is we're giving every single one of them a home. So they're organized, structured, and focused. And the reason that we do that, even though it's, you know, you go from having 10 campaigns inside of an account into 100, is we now know what's happening with all the campaigns that matter, all the keywords that matter. We're now so much better able to focus on what's working. And more importantly, when something inevitably goes wrong, we're able to look at the campaigns and say, which one of these individual campaigns stopped working? Which one of these individual campaigns overspent? Which one of these individual campaigns had a conversion rate fluctuation? And so the work that it takes up front to do this gets paid off in spades when things go wrong. Because, and I've been doing this for 6, maybe 7 years now. Things go wrong no matter how good you are and how, practically speaking, like what do you do? Like one of the things we do is we use software to manage our bids, and then we and also proactively manage negative keywords. So we'll set up like a, if this product gets 35 clicks and no sales, negate the search term that those clicks came from. Those kinds of rules we will set up. But then the rest of it is work that we'll proactively do inside of the account. And that just comes from realizing that the biggest outcomes inside of a camp or inside of any Amazon account will primarily come from a handful of keywords. So realistically, we want to get everything else to be slow and steady and predictable, most importantly, and then focus on the VIPs. So that's like the practical how-to of this. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, look, everything comes with a price tag, right? So it's not important how much. So this is a bit of a side, you know, I like stories always. So there is a gentleman by the name of Lenski, Mayor Lenski. Have you heard of him?
No.
Mayor Lenski. He managed all the financial affairs of the mafia. But this guy was so smart. He grew up in Israel as a kid. He was a true business person, but not necessarily to do business, but to stay on top of numbers. So anyway, the moral of the story is one day they are having a meeting. The mafia, all the bosses and everybody all together, and he recommends making an investment in Cuba in that before the revolution into a club. And as soon as he puts the idea on the table, one of the bosses says, "Do you realize how much it's going to cost to set up an operation like that?" His response is, "Never ask how much something is going to cost. Ask what it's going to do for you." So the price doesn't matter. So, you know, we all pay the price for all kinds of things. Like you pay the price exercising, right? So you're sweating, it's never fun. Well, why are you doing it? Because it's going to pay off by being healthy, on the buying medicine and going to doctors and suffering. So
yeah,
that's my little side story. So the price that you pay on organizing the advertising this way is very little compared to the amount of time you're going to spend to figure things out. But most important, to drive things in a real specific way, right? And measurable way.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you might say to yourself, well, I don't know where I could see growth inside of my Amazon account. You're never going to say that again once you have yourself set up this way. Because once you're set up in a very organized fashion and you know where all your top performing keywords are, really all you have to ask yourself is, am I willing to spend more on this keyword to grow my sales velocity? And will that pay off for me in organic sales, or will I be able to make these sales profitably? And then if the answer to that is no, then you go hunting for your next keyword, or you go looking for your next product opportunity. But you never again have to say, well, I don't know what to do inside of my advertising. It's more a question of, do I have worthwhile opportunities inside of my Amazon advertising?
Yeah.
And that's the goal of this structure, is to take away that time-consuming mess.
Yeah. I have a question for my listeners. Are you experiencing cash flow challenges with your Amazon business? Well, silly question. Who is not, right? So let me introduce you to Viably, a unique solution tailored for Amazon sellers and e-commerce enterprises. By connecting your Seller Central or Shopify account, you can promptly access funding along with a variety of financial tools, all for a flat fee. It's as simple as that. And for my listeners, they are offering an extra $1,500 in funding for eligible applications. Start your quick and easy application today at runviably.com/legends. And that's runviably.com/legends. And then also, there is another thing here, which really is going to be a good segue to our next topic, is the search query performance. So on one side, you've got a list of all your keywords that are spending money to drive you business. And then on the other side, you have search query performance that's giving you the keywords that are driving you, that are bringing you business. And then when you compare the two sets, you say, oh, wait a minute. These keywords, I'm already indexed and getting business, but I'm not even advertising. Add them on. And yeah, it's very easy. And vice versa. Anything that you are advertising, spending money on, of course, you know, you can see those. But when you correlate with search query performance, now you've got a whole different way to get results, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the search query performance report is one of the most underutilized reports. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that it's confusing. So if it's okay with you, I actually kind of want to just take a second and explain what it is, like define it, because the definition is so important.
Yes.
Yeah. So the search query performance is actually quite simple. They're showing you the organic and paid impressions, clicks, add to carts, and purchases on searches. What does that not include? That does not include product pages, from as far as I know. Or if it does, it may or may not, but they've never given a clear definition. It doesn't include other placements on Amazon, and doesn't include external traffic on Amazon. And Amazon doesn't give you a breakdown of any of those things anywhere else. So you just have to assume that while there is clear search volume, you might not be getting all of that information in the search query performance. So you can't use search query performance to get a clear organic sales to paid sales representation. And the attribution window is different, because in the search query performance report, it's a 24-hour attribution window. So impressions within the last 24 hours, clicks in the last 24 hours, add to carts, and then sales. But in the search term report, it's in the last 7 days. So if you get a click on a term and then 6 days later or 7 days later, you make a sale, that gets attributed to that ad campaign. But that same click in the search query performance report would not attribute that as a sale, because it did not happen within the same day, same 24-hour period. And so Amazon put together a great glossary that they made size 4 font in order for people to go onto their search query performance definition section and read. And when I went and looked at it, I thought, come on, guys, like, you couldn't even make this text bigger. It's hard to understand the wording, even if you're zoomed in. But zoomed out and with all this messiness, it's a great report that has been made so confusing. And there's so many great pieces of information in there that you can use to really maximize your results. But right now, nobody even knows what it is, so they're just ignoring it.
No. So let's dissect that search query performance and so that people understand. But more important, what you've done just a minute ago is explain what it does not include. So because it's very misleading, especially with this attribution business. So just for the listeners' benefit, attribution means that you have traffic coming in and somebody clicks on something. And let's say that they did attribution. I don't want to complicate things, but let's stick to the attribution definition. Amazon attribution is. So let's say that you are driving external traffic and you sent out an email campaign and you added the attribution tags to your email campaign. So for brand registry sellers, this is something that's available in your advertising area where you can create attribution tags. And that way, anybody who responds to your email campaign and comes to the product page and makes a purchase, that will be categorized as whatever the campaign definition you created is. So it's email campaign, for example, or email one, or Mother's Day email, whatever the case may be. So that's where that sale is attributed to. And equally, you can run Facebook ads, Google ads. You can put a button on your website and drive traffic from your website. These are all things you can individually define as attributions, attribution tags, and then the sale will be reported accordingly. And as far as the attribution that you were talking about, if you advertised on Amazon, you ran a PPC campaign, and then somebody clicked on it, and then they looked at the product, they didn't buy it. Mm-hmm. But they added to their cart because they liked the product. I do that all the time. And then 3 days later, I come back and buy it. Mm-hmm. So now the add to cart date and purchase date, totally different, 3 days apart. So the ad campaign or ad reports show that as a sale for what date, and search query performance shows that as a sale on what date. I think that's what you were referring to, right?
So in that case, so let's just talk really specific here. Nick goes onto Amazon and looks at a pair of tennis shoes. He searches tennis shoes, and then he clicks the first appearing top of search sponsor product ad. He goes to that page. He looks at the product. And he's like, this is exactly what I need. So Nick adds the cart. Then Nick waits 3 days. Then Nick purchases. How does that appear inside of these two different reports? In the sponsored product search term report, that would appear as a click and an order and one unit sold. In the search query performance report, that would be one impression, one click, one add to cart, and zero purchases because of that 3 day wait, because search query performance report is only a 24 hour attribution window. So if, for example, Nick were to view the impression, click on the ad, then not do anything, come back 3 days later and add to cart and then purchase, that would also not appear under the search query performance report because that add to cart was outside of the 24-hour window. Well, now, however, there is something to be said. There's an edge case there, which is how would Nick get back to that page? You would basically either have to leave the tab open or search again or add to your list. We don't have any information about list ads, but I assume list ads are not categorized at all. So those are the three different ways or three different scenarios that could happen. And that's how search query performance works.
You can also bookmark the page. Oh,
that's true. You could also bookmark yet another way. Yeah. And so if you bookmark and came back more than 24 hours later and then added to cart or purchased, though that would not appear inside a search query performance, but it would if show up in a campaign report or sorry, a search term report, if you had clicked on a sponsored product ad to get there.
Yeah. Now, what I'm getting from this conversation is two things, Sean. One is do not ever try to compare reports from advertising to search query performance or business reports because they'll never agree, right? Mm-hmm. They'll never agree. So because in really, if you want to think logic, one could easily say, oh, I take the same time frame, say, you know, they go by week numbers, so week 38. So pull the week 38 report for advertising from the advertising console and search query performance, and business reports, really, in principle, business reports show the total sales. Well, where do sales come from? Sales come from searches. So total sales from search query performance, they're not going to agree, right?
Well, sales come from searches and some other places. And Amazon does not categorize them for us. What do we know? So we know that sponsored products can, well, any campaign will have three, maybe now four different placement options. So there's top of search, so search, product pages, not search. Well, may or may not be search, because technically you can appear on a product page from a search term. So we're not sure how Amazon defines that, but TBD. So it could be a search. And then rest of search, definitely search. So even in there, that could be 33% that comes out right away. Now, we also have sponsored products that will sometimes appear on things like BuzzFeed and other partner websites. So that's also not search. And then there's external traffic. So your email campaigns, people searching, going to like listicles and different stuff. So that's also not search. And then on top of all that, there are placements that Amazon does or does not consider to be search. So underneath the buy box, when it says consider a similar item, is that a search or is that not a search? Amazon doesn't define it, but I'd be willing to bet that all those organic placements are not considered search. And so there's potentially 60, like depending on how you slice it, between 30 and 60% of the sales that are coming from or that happening on Amazon that aren't coming from search, and Amazon won't define them for us. So we kind of just have to make some bold assumptions and hope that they hold. Yeah. And so, yeah.
So but here is what I am getting. Again, very simplistic approach, same time frame, business reports. First of all, business reports will give you the total sales during that time frame. Doesn't matter where they came. Mm-hmm. That's your pie. That's the pie. That's the size of the pie. Now, the size gets split. In my book, that pie has three pieces. Mm-hmm. Organic, paid, external. That's very, you know, there isn't a fourth slice that I can think of. It's either organic that took place by somebody searching a keyword and then you came up, they clicked on it and they bought it, or you paid money to Amazon to drive traffic, or you drove it directly to your listing and then somebody bought it. Mm-hmm. So there is all these things. Now, the things like frequently bought together and blah, 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 blah. Well, what do you call those? Well, it will fall into one of these three at the end of the day. If you are advertising product display, that's paid ad. If you are frequently bought together, well, guess what? That's organic, right? So, yeah. So now the beauty of this calculation is, well, how do you calculate the organic? Well, it's very simple. You take your total business reports minus your paid sales minus your attribution sales. Whatever is left is your organic. Who cares whether it's frequently bought or it was in the cart, forgot. So that's your organic. So that's the thing. But this is what I have just discovered with this conversation. A fourth piece of that pie. Keyword search sales.
Well, technically, those keyword search sales are organic sales. But the problem that you're facing and everyone else is facing is that we don't know which of these keyword search sales are organic and which ones are paid, because the attribution windows are different. And so I'm pretty sure this was purposely done by Amazon to make sure that you can't really see what's going on. But what we've been able to kind of put together is not necessarily care so much about which keyword searches are we getting the most organic sales versus paid sales. What we end up using the search query performance report for is we blend two different brand analytics reports. So search query performance and the top search term report. And then we blend our sponsored products search term report, because traditionally we spend about 80% of our budget on sponsored products. And then we sort by sales volume and then filter by relevancy. And we say to ourselves, what percentage of our spend is going to our top terms? What percentage of our spend is going to terms that aren't as relevant or maybe too broad? Where are we underspending? Where are we overspending? And there's all kinds of golden nuggets in there that it's the first thing I do whenever I look at a new account. It's like, where, like, I almost can make a little treasure map.
So, Sean, before you go any further, we're going to make an announcement here. Okay. So we have just started talking about search query performance. So we're going to bring you back for part two conversation on search query performance, because how we're going to use it, that alone is a long discussion. And the way you are explaining is specific. I want to hear all that. And then I want to also address some particular scenarios, because that those are best ways for people to understand. And we'll do that. So let's spend the next few minutes before we wrap up, because, you know, time flies when you're enjoying yourself. And this conversation is so good. You know, we are almost coming up to an hour. So what we want to do is with search query performance. So we now clarified what it's not. But there's one more thing here. That, remember, I said there are two things here I take away. Never compare anything, because they'll never agree. The second thing is search query performance only shows you the keywords that were used in searches that showed your product, and then what happened as a result of that search term. Out of your product may have been shown as impressions.
Mm-hmm.
They may have clicked on it, so you'll see the click. They may have added to cart, so you'll see cart ads. Mm-hmm. And then they may have purchased it, so they'll see it as purchases. So you see all four things, keyword by keyword, as long as the cart purchase is and the cart ads took place within 24 hours of doing that search. If it goes beyond 24, you don't see that in the search query performance report either, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a 24-hour deal. So if you're not seeing it, and you know for a fact that this search term did yield this many, I'm looking at the ad report and I'm seeing it organic and I don't see it here, something is wrong, that's because it didn't happen in 24 hours.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And it's, you definitely don't want to push too hard to try to blend the data and make them match perfectly, because the issue is you can't. And it looks like it's by design by Amazon. So,
yeah. You know. There is one other thing here that throws a curveball. So I am the kind of person who likes to dissect things to understand. So what does that mean for Amazon operation? I want to see SKU by SKU how I'm performing, what SKUs I'm advertising, what keywords I'm advertising for that SKU, and how much am I paying, how much am I generating, because ultimately I'm selling the SKU. So I know how much I'm generating on the SKU, and I want to know how much I'm spending on that SKU. And that's not possible, is it? Because you have sponsored brands. Mm-hmm. They don't come with a SKU, right?
Yeah. And so that's the point of having a well-thought-out structure, is you want to look for where can you maximize your spend and get the best return, but still have the flexibility to also be able to spend on things like sponsored brands, headline ads, where you could potentially get a good return if you're able to find something that works. So The idea behind that is just to make sure that you're using the ad types for a specific purpose and focusing on that purpose and not mixing it all up, because then if you're able to use it all for one purpose, you can then maximize that purpose. And so, yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, everything comes down to it in life. It's focus, right? It's stay focused. What is that? And they always say, okay, what is that one thing you could say to people that would convince them? Okay, what is that one purpose that you're running this campaign for? That's really what it is. Well, this is a great conversation that delivers great value and probably gets a lot of people scratching their heads and holding their heads. Oh my God, what am I going to do now? But that's the reality. So I have one question I want you to answer, but not now. I'm going to put the question to you just like they do in talk shows. We're going to do the same. So the question you're going to answer on the second episode. Okay. What would you say to someone who wants to wipe the slate clean and reorganize their advertising because it got started the wrong way and they want to fix and now switch to the right way? Don't answer me now. You're going to answer me on the next episode. But at least say this. Is it possible?
It's very possible, but be careful. So I'll save all the good stuff for the next discussion, but it's very possible, but you have to do it a very specific way. And so please listen to the next episode. Like, this is not like a sales pitch. Like, if I'm going to teach someone how to do it, I want to really take the time to do it, because that I've seen it go wrong 100 different ways. And there's one way where it goes right. And I promise to, like, I will not get off the next call until I give a detailed response, because I really care about teaching and like sharing the stuff that I've learned. And so, yeah, definitely next call, I will give like, I'll try to give as much detail as possible about exactly how to do it.
Well, this is as close to a cliffhanger you can get in a podcast.
Yeah, right. Wow. Well,
Well,
I'm sure someone hates us now.
because listen, I don't want to rush it because we've got a few minutes left. And in that few minutes, I want to get to know Sean, who Sean Stone is. Tell us your story. And you know that some of my listeners call this the therapy session. This is where we get to know what really drives you. So tell us, start from the beginning. Tell us, where did you grow up? And give us some of your early life experiences.
Yeah, so I grew up in a place called Thunder Bay, Ontario, in Canada. It's a small city of 100,000 people, and the next closest city in each direction is at least 8 hours by car. Our claim to fame is that we produce the most NHL players per capita of anywhere in the world. And I grew up playing hockey and snowboarding and, enjoying the outdoors, the Great White North. The way that any other Canadian kid did.
So, what was the transition to the entrepreneurial numbers, systems, processes? When did that happen?
Well, I knew that Thunder Bay didn't have what I wanted. So when I graduated high school, I decided to go to Ottawa, which is Canada's capital. That's where I went to school. I studied business and marketing. And I pretty quickly noticed that the people who get to actually do important things are the ones who spend time convincing people to do things, not necessarily the ones who actually end up sitting around and doing the work per se. And so, whether that's marketing or sales or managing a big group of people to achieve some task. And so, what I, that was kind of what made me think of entrepreneurship in the most. Or how I've always thought about entrepreneurship is the person who can make the judgment calls and get everyone to do what needs to be done in order to achieve a common goal. So, I went to school and I studied that. And then I just thought, okay, well, I don't know if I'll be an entrepreneur right away, but that's definitely the direction I'm going.
So, but this must have been something that you realized even growing up with some of the games you played and some of the interactions you had. It can't be until you graduated from college.
No, I had a neighbor who was an entrepreneur, and he sold like construction equipment. And so he was a French Canadian guy named Danielle. And he was like the father to the neighbor's kids who we were friends with. And so we would all hang out all the time. And he took me in his big work pickup truck one time, and he had a satellite telephone in there. And I used the satellite telephone while he was driving his truck and called home to be like, "Hey, I'm using a satellite phone." And my mom was like, "What is that?" But nobody had a cell phone back then. Like I was using this piece of technology that nobody had ever even used before. And my mom didn't even know what it was, but I managed to call her from a moving vehicle, which was a very novel concept back in the early 90s, I guess. I was exposed to an entrepreneur very young in life. But I didn't know that's what he was doing at the time. I just thought I didn't know what anyone's job was. But he gave me a lot of entrepreneurial ideas and told me about saving money and stuff like that. So that was maybe my first exposure to entrepreneurship. And then the other thing is playing hockey in a small place like Thunder Bay, they made you go sell chocolate-covered almonds. And the rich kids just got their parents to buy them, and then they had chocolate-covered almonds in the house. But my family was just more middle class. So my mom said, "We're going door to door and selling these." And every year I did it. And I would sell through them like that because I just knew, okay, great. I need to go and sell these chocolate-covered almonds, and that will pay for my hockey. So great. So those are the two things like very early in life that accidentally led to me being an entrepreneur.
Would you say that you received your first entrepreneurial training from your neighbor?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, he realized that I came back from somewhere and I had extra money, and I told him I was going to give it back to my parents. He said, "No, you keep that for yourself and you save it. You just made a profit." And like, I still remember it to this day. He was like, "You just made a profit. You're going to save that profit for later." And I'm like, "Oh." And I guess, you know, I was like five or something. And I just, I made a profit and by accident.
So he made an impact on you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You realized that. You knew that all along.
Yeah. And
so, you know, this is why you love teaching, because teaching makes an impact, and you know the impact that this man made on you.
Yeah, definitely. I probably wouldn't have gone this path. I probably would have worked a manual labor job if I hadn't met him.
Wow. Talk about pivotal moments, huh?
Yeah, right.
That's what life is about. The funniest thing is you don't get to realize these things, that they happened, you know, at the time they happened. He probably told you, you know, that you made a profit, don't spend it, don't give it to your parents. And then you listen and said, "Oh, okay." And you probably did what he said and never thought about it again. And then as yet, that's when the stars aligned for you.
Yeah. That was when I learned a concept that ultimately drives this economy, you know? So it's very cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love stories like this, and I love trying to, you know, you analyze data, and I analyze data, we look at, but we are the data, right? So we don't analyze us. So this is very enjoyable. Well,
yeah.
Thank you, Sean. I cannot thank you enough. I'm sure people will follow this. I love this knowledge that you shared with everybody. And I'm dying to hear the way to transition from the current structure to the structure you suggested on the next episode, and then diving into search query performance. So thank you.
Can't wait.
And share with us in the meantime, how can people reach you if anybody wants to reach out?
Yeah. My website is stonesgoods.com, stonesgoods.com. And you can also find me, Sean Stone, on LinkedIn. That's SEANSTONE. Just go on LinkedIn and I'm very easy to find.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad we connected. And thank you for being here. And I will see you on the next episode.
Nick, thanks so much for having me. This has been awesome. Really appreciate it.
Before I go, a quick reminder to say goodbye to your cash flow problems and claim your extra $1,500 when you qualify for $25,000 or more in funding. Go to www.runviably.com/legends and start your application today. Thank you. And this brings us to the end of this episode. And I'll see you on the next one. And do not miss it, because you're going to get two real valuable things.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the episode. And share it with someone you think would benefit from it too.